countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
Good morning indeed. We are live from Bloom here in Dublin's Phoenix Park once again. It's a sort of cloudy morning, but it's not raining at least. And rain or shine, the gates will open in about three quarters of an hour in the show gardens, the postcard gardens, the nurseries, the food market, the art exhibition, the Victorian walled garden, the Bloom Farmyard and the Crafts and Design Centre, and indeed the RTE stand here, will welcome thousands of visitors all throughout the afternoon. And our reporter, Louise Denver, has already had a little taste of Bloom.
There was a garden that I really liked. It had lots of water in it and lots of planting.
Is it that one around the corner there? The same one is our favourite. The colour theme purple runs the whole way through it, but yet it's not too strong. It's really beautiful.
I loved it.
It's the farm in Bloom. My name's Teddy Cashman. I'm a board member of Agriweir, a dairy farmer from Cork. I milk 190 cows just on the outskirts of Cork City, so farming is my thing. I just milked the cow there a while ago. You have a few Angus heifers here.
I'm Francesca McKenna.
I'm Kira Smith.
I'm Amy Everard.
And I'm Katie Tully.
So basically, we've won these calves last year in transition year.
It's the Irish Angus Ute Challenge.
We have Belinda and Bambi with us today. We held a competition in school for what we should name the calves, and then we brought them here today, and everyone seems to love them. So
if any young people are coming down to Bloom, they can meet Belinda and Bambi.
Yeah, exactly, and they're really friendly as well, so every time someone goes to rub them, they give them a big lick, which is great.
Oh, sure, the whole lot is interesting. This is my fourth time here. I'm after buying the strawberries, tomatoes and the dill.
Cheese. Atlantic sea salt from Ackle.
So this is farmers to market, free range chicken. I suppose the major differences visually is in the shape of the bird, in that the legs seem longer, and that's because the muscle is more toned. When the bird gets more exercise, the muscle tones more. And the flavour of the bird, it's a meatier flavour.
We'll be doing samples now, do we? Do you want to try some?
Yeah.
Rapeseed oil, yeah, and a little tiny bit of sea salt, just the sea salt and a bit of lemon as well.
Right. Irish sea salt, isn't it?
That's it, yeah.
I'm Margaret Farley, formerly OEG. What's the brand now?
It's Margaret's brand now. We have a full range almost switched over to Margaret's. We have the fridge, which has our pasteurised products in it, which we're using to cook omelets.
We're at the Clonakilty Distillery stand in Bloom. So we're putting the icing out to the cocktail, getting it ready. So we had a very busy day, served a lot of these gin and tonics. Minky Gin is our new gin, just released in the market in the last year or so. It's a whey-based gin, so we have our own family farm down in West Cork, where we use the whey from the dairy cows to make the gin itself.
My name is Ken Norton. I'm the PRO for the Federation of Irish Beekeepers Associations in Ireland. Now, you might be wondering why we're in a holly tunnel full of fruit and veg. However, without the bees, we wouldn't have any of this.
My name is Amy Cahill. I make natural skincare.
Oxygen skincare.
Yeah. So we're a natural skincare company based in Stony Better in Dublin 7. And all of the products are handmade locally in small batches using natural and organic ingredients where possible. Sustainability is at the core of what we strive for. So we use a lovely brown and amber glass recyclable jar.
This is the BIM aquamarine garden. So it's meant to represent a cross-section of a natural maritime environment.
It's natural. It's beautiful. It highlights the rubbish that's in the oceans.
Richard Kennedy, I work for Janssen and was project lead on the Grounded project.
So who are you donating this to?
So it's going to a number of centres, so Aware are actually taking the lead on that, and it's donated back to a number of centres, and hopefully it's going to live on and benefit people living or experiencing mental illness.
And this is the bee-friendly garden. We've been a bit too neat and tidy with our landscapes. We've mowed a little bit too much. We've cleared a bit too much. So we've kind of done our pollinators out of homes and food.
We've very much focused on a garden that is looking at native plants. I guess you can see there the bees are absolutely loving the planting that we've got. Loads of cornflower, we've got celandine, granny's bonnet, it's the aquilegia.
Louise Denver reporting there, and that's all from Louise, who was knocking around the different stands at Bloom. Well, we've come down to one of the gardens, and University College Dublin has created a garden celebrating the history of the Irish diet in plant form. Through the garden, they are sharing scientific research on the changes in the diet in this country over the past, wait for it, 8,000 years. And the garden has been awarded a Silver Gilt Medal. I'm joined here by the head of the project, botanist Dr. Caroline Elliott Kingston, and by archaeologist Dr. Muriel McClatchy. You're both very welcome. Thanks for coming along. I'll start with you, Muriel. First of all, the design of the garden, it begins 10,000 years ago or thereabouts, right up to the present day.
Yes, it begins. We have the first settlements in Ireland from about 10,000 years ago. And our first section shows what people would have been eating in Ireland around 8,000 years ago, hunter-gatherers.
Right, so that's that garden there. So what were we eating and how did we get our food? Hunter-gatherers, you said. Well, was the survival of the fittest, was it?
We're focusing on the plants in this, in the gathering section. So there's a wide variety of foods. We have nuts, a key staple at this time, hazelnuts in particular. We have many different types of fruits also, berries, things that would be familiar to us, and crab apples. We have lots of leafy greens, different types of leafy greens than we eat nowadays. So you have vetches, for example, and you have nettles, which can be eaten. And also you have tubers. So sometimes there's a perception in hunter-gatherers, we're not eating carbohydrates. We are. We're eating different types of very skinny little tubers, quite different to our modern ones like potatoes and carrots, but they're still there in our diet.
Right, and there are plants that were well known in the past, which we don't really eat much these days. For example, tell me about the fat hen.
Yes, the fat hen is a plant.
No, it's not. It hasn't got legs or a beak or anything like that. It is a plant.
Nothing like that. It's a plant that will be well known to gardeners, and they'd be pulling it out of their gardens probably this morning around Ireland. But it's a very useful plant and would have been useful in the past, and it's one we've forgotten about, perhaps. So the leaves from the fat hen can be used much like spinach. And indeed, it was used for centuries and centuries in that way. Even right up to the 18th century in Dublin, fat hen was being sold on the street by hawkers before spinach came along and replaced it. And also the seeds of fat hen can be very useful as well. So the Latin name for fat hen is Cynopodium album. It's closely related to Cynopodium quinoa, which is quinoa, its South American cousin. So maybe perhaps we could be reclaiming our Cynopodium album or fat hen, using it in the same way. You could be adding it into soups or stews. You can grind it up and add it into bread, lots of different ways.
Okay, so Caroline, as we move along through the ages, we're coming from being hunter-gatherers to foragers to farming then, is that right?
Yes, yeah. So Irish horticulture and Irish agriculture are critically important. We get all our vitamins and minerals, or many of them, from our fruit and veg. We have superb horticultural produce. We have superb agricultural produce in Ireland. From the point of view of sustainable eating, we should be eating more Irish produce. We have a lot of exotics now imported, which are in nice parts of our diet, but they do come with carbon miles and packaging.
Yeah.
So eating more locally is a much more sustainable way to have a good diet.
Yeah, and we did eat better, would you say, then, that we eat much healthier going back through the ages?
Well, we don't know that. We ate differently.
Yeah.
But I suppose a key point of this garden is that our early diet was very diverse. Hunter-gatherers have to eat everything they can get their hands on that's safe, but it was local. Now we eat quite a diverse diet, and some of it is global. So this garden, I suppose, gives us an opportunity to discuss, you know, what we've eaten in the last, since Ireland was settled in the last 8,000 years or so, but where are we going in the future with our diet? That's a critically important conversation we need to open up now.
All right, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that in a moment. But coming back to you, Muriel, we do obviously note the famine years as well here. You have some black potatoes.
Yes, we've shown. So our fourth section out of the five sections is showing the early 19th century when the potato was king. Lots of different varieties of potatoes we have. Other crops are still important. You have oat and you have rye, peas and beans. But there was something before we moved on to the modern day section. We're showing those key transitions in food in Irish society. And we wanted to mark the famine coming just after the early 19th century. So we placed that in between sections four and five, blackened potatoes to reflect the rotting potatoes from the famine.
And we were obviously so dependent on the potato then.
Absolutely, yes, for the last few centuries, but it's quite a late. That's been a surprise to many of our visitors here in the gardens today. Potatoes only came in here in the past few centuries, but they went from zero to hero pretty quickly.
Right, and the same question to you. Were we healthier way back?
It's very difficult to say. It depends on how you measure healthiness, I suppose. So what we can look at is diversity in the diet, but it's access. Mm. It's difficult sometimes to know that there were plants available broadly, but who could access them?
Yeah.
And then there's other things like interpersonal violence. So people, which we don't suffer from so much nowadays, we have perhaps safer societies to some extent.
Well, I suppose the question being, you know, healthier, we weren't healthier, obviously, way back and before penicillin and all that, but I suppose I'm talking about the actual diet and what we ate. Now, you don't actually have here, for example, a reflection of meat eating. This is all plant.
We do. What we have is we have in the grassland along here, so we're showing pastoral and interactions with animals here. So just in the middle sections, there's grassland, as you can see, becoming more improved, you might call it, through time, because animals were a key part of food. As soon as farming came in, you're seeing animals come in as well as the crops.
Right. And Caroline, finally, we, as I said, come up to the modern day garden and the sort of plants that we grow nowadays. I was just chatting to you a little bit earlier on. We get this impression, oh, we're all going back to growing our own and all of that. Is that the case?
No, not really. And actually, there's a huge disconnect between the way food is produced and what we eat. So most people now engage with food at the supermarket level. So there's very simple things we can do. For example, if you're picking up a packet of nuts, you might consider hazelnuts, which are grown in Ireland, rather than pistachios, which have come halfway around the world. So our produce here is absolutely superb quality. It's well produced. Our meat and milk, our fruit and veg. I think we have to think about where we're going in the future, but certainly from an environmental point of view, which is critically important and very important to me, I think we need to have some kind of mindfulness around our diet and to try and eat locally, to try and eat seasonally if we can, to broaden our diet, but using stuff that doesn't come halfway around the world. I wouldn't knock that. I mean, we love all these. I love bananas, I love avocados, I love all these exotics, but maybe we should start thinking about those as treats rather than everyday foods.
Well, and as well as that, we're an island nation, we export a lot of food as well, so, it's a bit of a contradiction,
well,
I suppose.
No, global trade is very important. We still need to keep eating these, we need to import food, we need to export our food, but just perhaps we should consider that Irish produce is so good that maybe we could consider that as our first choice.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed to Muriel and to Caroline at the UCD Garden. More details at ucdgarden.com. This is The Lark in the Clear Air. Fantastic. That was absolutely super. That was Lark in the Clear Air, known to many as the theme music of the popular radio programme presented by the late Ciara Macmahona, called Mhuil Thú, played for us this morning by Evelyn Grant on flute, Gene Kelly on concert harp, and Jerry Kelly on cello. Thank you very much, guys. We might hear from a little bit more from you later on. Thanks for joining us on Countrywide this morning. Now, this time last week, the country was in the middle of sorting and shuffling ballot papers as counting begun in the European and local elections, as well, of course, of the referendum and mayoral plebiscites as well. But next week, they will continue the job of sorting, shuffling and counting in the Ireland South constituency. But from being a complete outsider, Saoirse McHugh became a contender to take a seat for the Green Party in Ireland Midlands Northwest, an unexpected turn of events for the first time candidate, and she's here with me this morning. Saoirse, good morning.
Morning, how are you?
What a week.
Oh, stop. I've only just started sleeping again.
Can you describe what it was like last weekend from the moment of that exit poll, which gave you a chance, you know, from then, I suppose, until your elimination in the early hours, I think, of Wednesday morning. What was it like?
As soon as the exit polls came out, I was like, no, that's just an exit poll. There's a huge margin of error. I had to try and calm Dad down. He was leaping around the kitchen. I was like, be cool. Come on. It's just an exit poll. And from then on, I did not sleep until probably Monday when the first count came out, because I was looking at it and I was seeing where transfers might come from.
Yeah. And was this something you were used to? You know.
Not at all.
No, you weren't.
My first time ever at a count.
Really?
It was my first, and I've become obsessed with it. Like, I was watching them tally the seconds and then calculating whose votes might go where.
Yeah.
I get really into it.
That was all new to you, really,
yeah.
Was it?
It's really impressive, actually. I've underestimated the voting system in Ireland. It is so impressive. People going around with shopping trolleys of ballots. Like, it's really cool.
Yeah.
But when the first count came out, I kind of knew I wouldn't be able to catch up. And I was disappointed at first, and then after a few hours, I could really start to enjoy it, because up to then, I was just anxious. I would go to bed at maybe 1 o'clock, and I'd lie there trying to pretend I could sleep, and I'd be up at five, you know, looking at Twitter or seeing had anything else come out.
And you were talking as well about at one stage wondering as well, where am I going to live in Brussels? Have you ever been to Brussels?
I have.
Right.
Yeah. I've been to Brussels. Well, actually, when the exit poll came out, my very, very first reaction was, I don't want to go to Brussels. I want to stay here. And my brother was looking at me. He was like, what? You are going to Brussels if you get a seat. So obviously, had I gotten a seat, there would have been a lot of emotional adjusting, but I didn't this time.
You didn't get an awful lot of media coverage, and that was talked about. And then there was the prime time, obviously, debate where you shone and you really, I suppose, arrived on the political scene in a lot of people's eyes. You know, this debate about the media coverage, which you didn't get, maybe that one was just what you needed rather than any more than that?
Well, but it's not just me. There's 17 candidates in the Midlands Northwest, and I'd say most people could name maybe 8. Mm. And it's consistent, I think, that if you get media coverage, you're more likely to be voted for. And the same with posters, you know, they say that the main thing is face and name recognition. Yeah. And there's nothing better than national media for that. So,
but you wouldn't have had much face or name recognition.
No, but I was on primetime.
Right.
And I don't think if I was on primetime, like, I was knocking on doors for 4 months before that. And I found myself thinking, geez, I didn't even need to bother that. The amount of work we put in before that, and I'd say primetime just kind of
did
it all for us.
How nervous were you going on to that show?
I was so nervous. You know, when you read about people saying their throat was going to close up, it was the first time I'd ever actually experienced that. Yeah. And I was sculling water, you know, they've water on little tables behind you. And Maria McGuinness was beside me, and she said, stop that, you'll have to wee. And so she's handing me Tic Tacs, but my throat kept closing up. My mouth was so dry and the lights were so bright, and it was just, I was terrified.
Right, so you got support from Raid McGuinness.
Yeah, I think they all felt a bit, because I was, I looked like a woman going to her death, right, walking onto it.
By the way, what is a trope?
A trope is like, you know, almost a caricature, an old stereotype. Right.
Well, it's a word that
story.
A lot of people didn't hear before until you arrived.
Well, I hope I used it right now.
Well, it certainly is something that's going to be there forever when we look back on this election. Were you always a Green? Were you always a Green with an interest in going into politics?
I was not politically affiliated. But
did
I was,
you come from a family of political
no,
animals? No.
No, I was always environmentally aware, I suppose, really environmentally aware. Like, most of my life has been riddled with guilt over what I'm eating or what I'm wearing or where I'm going, and it's been very uncomfortable for years. And I was going to different politicians looking to get an environmental policy that all parties could sign up to, because there's a load of bills sitting in front of the government that could be passed and would have a really big effect, but it looks like it's just kind of point scoring at the moment. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I thought if there was something everyone could sign up to that wasn't affiliated to any one party, then maybe we'd have a chance. And it was in one of these conversations with Eamon Ryan that he suggested that I run. And in like about 2 years of going to politicians and telling them what they should do, it had never even occurred to me to run.
And had you got any interest in politics? Would you have watched election counts in the past?
No, I'd be interested in policy.
Right.
Politicians kind of always feel different. Like I said, it never even...
And there was a very famous politician in your constituency for many years, Enda Kenny.
Yeah, Enda Kenny.
Is he somebody that you knew? Did you talk to him about policy?
I know, I've been talking to him before about years. I have a long history of being ignored by politicians and their secretaries. I'd gone to him before about, you know, Seed Savers Ireland funding had been cut. I remember years ago, and Simon Coveney was Minister of Agriculture at the time, and I could not get through to Simon Coveney. So I had to go through Enda to get to Simon Coveney, because, of course, I'm one of Enda's constituents.
Yeah.
And Simon Coveney never got back to me. I'm still waiting. I'm sure there'll be a reply one day.
All right. Well, he's moved on, of course, from that department. Yeah. He was Minister for Agriculture. And there is this, you know, maybe it's a misconception that the Greens have no support among farmers. And I suppose outside Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, there's not many parties have much support from farmers. And there was an exit poll published in the Farming Independent this week which showed that no farmers voted for you. That upset you?
Because it was a pile of rot. That's why. It was lazy nonsense. I looked at that when I saw it and I said,
Do you know that farmers
I know 50 off the top of my head who voted for me.
And what sort of farmers would they be now?
Well, I just got a text earlier off a man from Roscommon in the sheep. He runs the sheep festival up there.
Yeah.
And a lot of the hill farmers. So I think when people say farmers in Ireland, oftentimes they're trying to conflate big dairy with all farmers.
Yeah, when you look at the overall contribution, which we'll chat a little bit later about this, when you look at the overall contribution which agriculture makes to, you know, our national carbon footprint, it looks like a big figure. But on the ground, the people that you represent, the people, or you're not representing them, but the people that you were hoping to represent and that you were trying to get votes off, the smaller farmers, how environmentally aware are they, do you think?
I think they're really environmentally aware. I think a lot of the problem is the Common Agricultural Policy was written to provide abundant, cheap, safe food for Europe. Mm. And its goal still hasn't really changed much to reflect what we're facing
keeps
now.
Keeps food cheap for us to buy.
It does.
Yeah.
But at the time, food shortage was the biggest issue. And at the time now, climate breakdown and biodiversity loss is the biggest issue. And I don't know if the agricultural policy itself has the tools to reflect that, because it is just an agricultural production policy.
So the cap needs to change. Do farmers have anything to fear from the Greens? Can you work a lot together, do you think, for the future, for the betterment of their future
totally.
And the future of the environment?
Because agriculture, well, the way I see it, and I could be totally wrong, it's the biggest interface between society, environment and economy that we have. And so there's no choice. Like, it's not farming or the environment. There's no either or. It can't be. And all
they
farmers know that.
They can coexist and farmers can make money and the environment can thrive.
Have to.
Right.
Because otherwise nobody wins. Otherwise farmers don't make money in the end.
Are we going to see you run for the general election? That'll be a different beast altogether. And we know how crowded Mayo can be as a constituency. Would you run in some other constituency?
I wouldn't run anywhere else.
Right.
And I've thought about the logistics of Mayo. I was just talking to someone in the Green Party last night and they were like, oh yeah, it'd be a walk in the park. I was like, you have not been to Mayo.
A beast of a constituency.
Yeah. So I've definitely considered it.
Right. But in the meantime, you're going to take a little bit of a break.
Yeah, I'm going to get a tan somewhere.
Right.
Head off to Croatia.
You're heading off to Croatia. By train, boat and train.
By boat and train,
today.
Yeah. for a Tuesday. Week.
On Tuesday, okay, yeah. For a well-deserved break. And in the meantime, it's your first visit to Bloom, so I'll let you go and have a look at the gardens.
Thanks, Minnie.
Saoirse McHugh, thank you very much. And we look forward to chatting with you again in the future. Thanks a million.
Thanks
indeed.
For
Green
me.
Party candidate Saoirse McHugh on Countrywide this morning on her first visit to Bloom. Up Mayo. All right, coming up on Countrywide and still to come on the programme, we'll be chatting to the CEO of Amborbia, Tara McCarthy, and we'll also be chatting to some of the small artisan food producers that are showcasing here at Bloom. Are you all enjoying yourselves, ladies and gentlemen? Those of you that are here...
The early birds,
indeed. One of them being Karen O'Donoghue. Good morning to you, Karen.
Well, good morning. How are
you? You're the community manager with Grow It Yourself and, of course, co-presenter of RTE's Grow, Cook, Eat and founder of the Cottage Markets.
That's
so me. What are you doing here?
So I'm here having a brilliant time meeting all the people who love to grow some of their own food and who also really value fantastic handmade local products and doing a bit of a random karaoke on the DIY Food Matters stage because, you know, it is Bloom.
And DIY, we were chatting a little bit about it. You know, it's a very niche sort of area, but it's a growing area, isn't it?
Oh, I think we're well out of niche. We definitely have big plans to make growing your own food far more mainstream than it currently is, but we have absolutely moved away from the kind of do-gooder or even hipster mode of a lifestyle choice. We work with about 500,000 people currently across Ireland and the UK, running massive award-winning campaigns in schools and homes and workplaces and the community. So yeah, no, we're bigger and have big plans.
Right, and briefly, what have you got here? And
yeah.
You brought a bag of goodies for us.
So I'm here representing the Cottage Market crew. So the Cottage Market is a community-led initiative. There's 25 cottage markets all around the country. And a big happy birthday to the Cottage Market in Mount Rath and Newbridge, who are celebrating their second birthday today. I won't sing, I promise. And I'm not going to jump out of the basket either, a la Marilyn. So we have with us a basket of things that have been made, like copper creations, beautiful homegrown herbs, of course the brown bread, beeswax wraps, the honey and even laundry detergent.
Oh, right.
And I suppose it's a bit of a mixed bag, but it's just a way of illustrating that A, there's an extraordinary amount of talent in people's kitchens, garden sheds, workshops, allotments and whatnot up and down our glorious country. And these are people in urban and rural communities who are coming together on a weekly or monthly or fortnightly basis and creating a real hub of enterprise.
Okay, and people can visit your stand here at Bloom.
Absolutely.
And will you leave that basket there for me? Thank you very much.
I will, gladly.
Okay. Well, we're also here by joined by Niall Phelan of YR Sauce from the Love Irish Food Tent. I never knew the YR Sauce was Irish.
That's the biggest myth, actually, that we have to deal with, and one of the reasons we're here today.
Tell us about the history of YR.
Around since 1837, it originated from the Spice Trail, actually, so the ingredients would have never been available before that. It's been made in Ireland for at least 100 years, in Donegal first, now in Dublin, and we're just here to sort of tell the story. It's made with, you know, vegetables, onions, fruit, some natural spices, a little bit of sugar. It's a really good product.
And a lot of people will remember YR sauce as a special occasion sauce.
Yeah, it's a Christmas Eve, back from Mass with the family. The ham comes out of the oven. A couple of slices are stolen off the side on a batch pan if you're from Dublin. And then, you know, a quick feed and maybe a Mexican beer before you go to bed.
Well, we're going to talk to about the Mexican beer now in a second as well. But YR sauce, you learn something new every day. Irish, indeed. Thanks very much for that. Now, we're joined here by Maeve O'Malley. We're back to Ackle again. Maeve, Ackle Sea Salt and the Sea Salt Experience. It's a family business.
Yeah, it is. So we started in 2013. My mum was watching a documentary on sea salt production, and we thought, if they're doing it in the UK, why can't they do it in Ireland? So we started there, and we've grown ever since. We now have a custom-made facility in Ackle Island, where we offer tours for people to come and see your store, or see our process, and learn about our story.
Right, and you are part of the Fáilte Ireland Taste of Ireland seminar. Tell me a little bit more about that, and how Fáilte Ireland are, I suppose, collaborating and joining the food, I suppose, experience and tourism together.
Yeah, so Fáilte Ireland are launching their new Taste the Island campaign, and this was really important for us to get involved because we've just launched our new visitor centre. food tourism is becoming really popular now. So we just wanted to get on board, to have an opportunity to promote ourselves and to promote food in Achill, Mayo and all over Ireland.
Well, there's very much of a Mayo and an Achill flavour to this morning's programme. Your neighbour there, Saoirse, was ominous a little earlier. Maeve, thank you very much indeed for that. That's from Achill. Now, we are it wouldn't be countrywide at Bloom unless we had some beer at this hour of the morning. Good morning to you, Killian.
Good morning.
You're looking well. Tell us a little bit more about, we just mentioned there, the Meskin Brewery, and we're staying in Mayo because you're in Kilsallagh, isn't that right?
Yes, we're halfway between Westport and Lewisburg.
And you're here with Bart, and you're dressed like Franciscan monks. I don't know why, but anyway, it's part of the selling point.
I can easily explain that. Meskin was a monk in St. Patrick's entourage, and he brewed beer for the Holy Man. And our brewery is on the side of Croagh Patrick. We make, Bart is Belgian, I'm obviously Irish. Neither of us originally from Mayo, but Mayo has taken us in and we're
Is it a crowded market, the whole craft beer business?
It is a crowded market. What we do is rather different from what most other breweries are doing in this country. So because Bart is Belgian and our interest is in Belgian beer, we make exclusively Belgian styles. So we're sort of ploughing a slightly different furrow from what other people are doing.
All right, so vets turned brewers, both of you.
Yeah, we did 25 years of veterinary each, and we decided that after a lot of pulling calves, we might pull a few pints. So it was sort of an exit strategy. We enjoyed the vetting, but the four in the morning call-outs were becoming a bit tough.
All right,
we thought we'd do something different.
But you go for an easier life, more enjoyable one. Thank you very much. Good to see you, Bart, as well, and Killeen, and they're both here, and we'll put it up on our Twitter page because they look fantastic. Everybody does. Thank you all indeed to our guests from the Food Village, and that's where a lot of you will be over the next 2 days because Bloom continues until Monday. Now it's time for the Snowy Breasted Pearl. That was the Snowy Breasted Pearl, arranged by T.C. Kelly and played this morning by Evelyn Grant on flute, Gene Kelly on concert harp and Jerry Kelly on a cello. Guys, thank you so much. And you're appearing all weekend, aren't you? Evelyn, yeah, here for the weekend.
All weekend.
Come along to the RT tent to hear that beautiful music on Lyric FM as well. Now, visitors to Bloom are always interested in trends in garden designs. This week, I took a trip around the gardens and I visited two in particular, one which illustrates the trends in gardening in the 20th century. Kevin Dennis designed a very 21st century garden, as he told me when I met him yesterday.
Yes.
Well, it's great to be here. I'd be a big fan of Bloom myself. I like to get involved in the show and I like to build the best garden I possibly can. I started to design this garden last November.
Right.
And then we came on site on the 2nd of May, started digging, got stuck in, and we've been working, I'd say, flat out, weekends, late nights, you name it, to the most serious deadline you've ever had on a project.
Well, look, will you describe to our radio listeners who can hear us but can't see us, obviously, what is the theme this year?
Basically, it's an urban sanctuary, and I'm trying to inspire people living in cities to become more engaged in their outdoor spaces, whether it's a balcony, small city space, or your regular suburban garden. But the theme is really about the contemporary Irish spirit, which is the people of today in Ireland. We've travelled the world. We might have been to Dubai, New York, Thailand, wherever it may be. So in the planting scheme, I said, I'm going to have some fun here. So we have these beautiful sago palms, saiga. Yeah. So they're structural. They make you feel like you're in Mexico.
Yeah.
And we have lots of dotted salvias, salvia royal bumba, little pops of red colour. Mm. The warm colour tones you see in the flowers will make you feel like you're in a hot climate. So with all these type of themes, you know, I'm giving this kind of international flair to this kind of new world we're living in.
Well, congratulations once again, Kevin. Your mantelpiece is going to require an extension if you keep on winning medals here. But we look forward to seeing you maybe hopefully again next year. Thanks very much and
thanks,
the best
Amy.
Of luck.
Thank Cheers. You. Thank you.
Sweet, sweet memories you gave me. From contemporary to nostalgic. Memories you
gave me. Take one fresh and tender kiss.
Memories are made of this. It's a 1950s themed garden, and it's featured as part of the HSE's Dementia Understand Together campaign. For many people in their late 60s or 70s living with dementia, the garden takes us back to a time when they were children. Award-winning garden designer Robert Moore worked closely with the Bloomfield Social Club from Rathfarnham in Dublin, from where he took design cues from people who remember the gardens of their childhood in 1950s Ireland.
Memories are made of this.
There was elements of the paving that a lady remembers her father doing because he was from Clare. Yeah. When they moved to Dublin, he just wanted a little bit of home, so a little bit of a connection with his own people. You know, so there's loads of things that's in this garden that kind of connect this garden to actual people now who are living with dementia. As you walk through the garden, I'll try and sort of bring you through it. The front garden is a very staged and very organised. It's sort of typical of the era. A lot of geraniums, snapdragons, roses, peonies. Then we move on a beautiful Lescanor pathway. It meanders through the garden into a back garden. The back garden is very pragmatic, full of edibles, full of fruit and veg and herbs. And it passes by the shed at the end of the garden, which, as I said, is our memory shed. And then it continues on into the broader landscape. The dementia issue is a national issue, so we didn't want this just to be a city garden. Where we are now is the end of the path. We're in the rural landscape. We've a beautiful stone wall. Mm. We've got a haycock, which you won't see too often in a show garden.
Yeah.
And the planting then becomes very wild and rural. And it just, where we are now is on these beautiful Lescanor benches. These are just, it gives us a place just to sit and reflect.
My memory is actually not bad at all.
I also met with Jacinta Dixon, who works with the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland, as she admired Robert's work. Jacinta herself has been living with dementia since 2016.
I can still go places. I was born, bred and up in Dublin, so I'm well able to get around, and that's not a problem for me. And I can look after my grandchildren from time to time, small things, just yes. Take them home from school and stuff. Can't go farther afield, which I would struggle getting to Wexford or somewhere now.
Did you, was it somebody else that noticed a difference in you, or did you notice it yourself?
It was me.
You're right.
Yes, it was my daughter. My daughter actually said it to me afterwards. I said, who thought about it? And she said, it was you. I actually had been working in the disability sector. My work began to get quite bad. I knew my work was bad, but I didn't know what to do.
Right.
My employers weren't happy, da, 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 and eventually I was basically asked to leave. I am now 69. So go back 3.5 years.
Right. The Alzheimer's Society of Ireland, how important is an organisation like that for somebody like you?
For me, to use the word lifeline isn't enough. It gave me back my life. It gave me back something to look forward to. And I go to meetings and I go and do things like this, not as good as this, but do this sort of thing. And also, it just gives me that sense of purpose, the feeling that I still have some bit of a head, you know, and I'm not stupid.
And that was Jacinta Dixon, whom I met at one of the gardens yesterday. And you'll see all of those gardens here at Bloom, as I said, which continues today, tomorrow, and indeed Monday. And it's organised by Borbia, and the CEO of Borbia is Tara McCarthy. Good morning, Tara.
Good morning, David.
How's it going?
It is going fantastically well. We've had no rain, and that's one of the key criteria for coming, but it's been brilliant.
Right, keep your fingers crossed. You still have a few days to go. Well, what's the difference? I mean, is this 12, 13 years of it now? You have to build, do something new the year after next. So what's new this year?
So this is our 13th year, and it's been a fantastic success so far. And I guess if I was to summarise Bloom, it's really about having your pulse on what's important to Ireland. And if you walk around Bloom, you feel that. And even if you look at the election recently, what were the big issues? All of them are here at Bloom. So it's about the climate, it's about biodiversity, it's about mental health, it's about physical well-being. All of those messages and ways of learning and educating yourself about them are here to be discovered at Bloom.
I want to talk to you a little bit about numbers, because Borbia is, I suppose, you're the food marketing wing of the government, and your job is to try and find markets around the world. We're an island nation, we got to export. So just paint a picture, I suppose, Tara, for, you know, Irish agriculture, Irish agri-food. What do we export? Where do we export? How much food are we producing and exporting abroad?
So food is the agri-food industry is the most important sector to indigenous sector that Ireland has, and it's our most important part of our economy. So we export in food alone, 12.1 billion euro to 180 markets around the world. And our two largest sectors are meat and dairy. They're about two-thirds of our exports. We have a vibrant alcohol and drinks industry. We have a seafood industry and a horticulture industry, as well as a prepared foods industry. They're your main blocks. And each of those then has a story within itself. With our meat industry, particularly beef, number one market is the UK, but most of that product is going to Europe. Our dairy industry is a very diverse industry. Again, UK playing about 25% of its exports, but then if you look at the bigger picture, China is its number two market. And then if you look at our alcohol industry, the US plays a huge role in that, taking a huge amount, almost a €500 million of our exports as well.
Now, you mentioned dairy and beef there making up a huge chunk of that 13 billion. But it's a sector that's in the spotlight. It's at the moment as we try to, I suppose, manage our climate change expectations with obviously sustaining these farmers around the country. How are we going to do that? Is dairy and beef, are they going to have to change their ways into the future?
I guess there's nobody immune from change, Damien. You know, if you're, no matter what industry you're in, you're going to have to change your ways. And I think we've all heard very, very clearly the importance of sustainability. But I think just if we put in context, it's as if the sustainability messaging, people think that's new to farming or that's new to the food industry. And if I put some context on that, when we look at the image we have overseas, Ireland has always been associated with green. And if I go back 7 or 8 years ago, we actually did some research on that when we were trying to understand how could we leverage the brand of our Irish food industry, and all of our markets came back and said, you are green, we know you're green, but can you prove it? And 7 years ago, almost 8 years ago now, we launched a program called Origin Green, which was around putting data behind this, not pictures, data. And that was around going out to farms, collecting information, putting benchmarks in there, so that if you don't know where you're starting, you don't know where you're going effectively. So what we've done in that time is got our farmers who have volunteered, this is not a legal backdrop. This is a volunteering process where our farmers have signed up. 50,000 meat farmers, 18,000 dairy farmers are all signing up to be measured. And then our industry, our processing industry, 90% of those have signed up as well. So it's not to say that our industry is immune to conversations on sustainability, but I would say it is very aware of it, and this isn't new to them.
But Origin Green and huge dairy and beef production, it does have its critics, as you know, Tara, and people say that, you know, it's a clever marketing ploy. Greenwashing has been mentioned as another phrase for Origin Green. How do you respond to that?
With a bit of disappointment when I hear that, particularly when you're globally being told that this is the first national program in the world. It is to date, after 7 years, still the only national programme in the world. So it's often good to look at what are our competitors doing, and we're very much ahead of that. But I would stress, Damien, this is not me being smug about we're fine. Absolutely not. We've reviewed Origin Green. We know it still has to improve and get better. We know that there is a very hard journey ahead of us, and we know this needs to be done collectively. So, you know, when I'm listening to Saoirse earlier on, everything she was saying, we would be 100% in agreement, because it isn't agriculture versus sustainability, it's agriculture and, but reframing that and making sure the frame is the right one, that has always been the case, but now it's being measured more acutely and we're up for that.
Okay, we know that diets are changing, but that seems to be more of an American and maybe first world issue where people are cutting out meat and all of that. I was interested to know, the demand for beef and dairy is actually growing globally, is that true?
Absolutely, and I guess that's as people become more wealthy, they have a desire to eat more meat and eat more dairy, and I guess in some ways have Western diets. People, however, are reflecting a lot, and we've done a lot of research on this as to what are the motivations for diets to understand better the consumer, and it's not anti or for any particular diet, but it's understanding the motivation so that our producers, whether horticulture producers or meat producers, understand that they can meet their needs. And there is a growing demand for people to ensure that they're eating well. And that's particularly in the first world markets, as you described, where people want to eat better. And what better means is natural. They want less processed. They want to understand the traceability. And I would argue that Irish product fits that need in first countries or in any country in the world.
And that's a message that you will be bringing to Japan next week with the Minister for Agriculture. You're just back from China as well, and you're trying to find new markets, obviously, to mitigate against the potential disaster that is Brexit, which we'll come back to at another stage. But for the moment, Tara McCarthy, CEO of Borbia, thank you so much for joining us on Countrywide as usual at this time of the year, and the very best of luck with the remainder of Bloom.
And one last message, that if anyone's thinking of what to do today, do come and join us here at Bloom.